them called Why Capitalism Causes Hypothermia and Closes Down Coal Mines. Our speaker, Steve Coleman, is going to talk for about half an hour, and then that should lead into points of view, questions, discussion, and then we'll have a break and see how it goes from there. So I'll ask Comrade Steve to start.
Thank you, Comrade Chairman, comrades and friends. I want to begin by making a simple statement, and that is that there is something very seriously wrong with a society which is stopping the production of coal because there is no economic need for it, while next winter, if it is like last winter, and if it is like the winter before that, and the winter before that, and the winter before that, tens of thousands of people, most of them old, all of them poor, all of them in vital need of coal-produced energy, will die because they lack access to heat. It is a perverse fact which will not be explained away by the lunacy of economic jargon, that the society of which we are all a part finds it more rational to let people die of the cold than to produce heat to keep them alive. That is a fundamental insanity of the society we're living in. It can't be explained away, and I, for one, and the Socialist Party as an organisation, will tolerate no argument and no principle which says that the abstract support of the dogma of unadulterated class greed is more important than the preservation of lives. And what we are talking about this evening is a social system which causes those problems. The society we live in is not just a collection of random accidents and individual problems. It is a social system. And I might add, it will not be dealt with by using the casual political vocabulary of attacking Thatcherism or monetarism or one policy against another policy or Maggie Maggie out out outism. That isn't the way in which one has a relevant and constructive political response to the perverse priorities of capitalism. So we begin to present our argument on the assumption that the world which surrounds us is packed full of sickening and dangerous contradictions, and those who choose to wear the blinkers of indifference, and others who imagine that the social tragedies of capitalism have to be accepted as facts of life, are free to give continued support to capitalism, which tramples upon human needs because of its own economic rationale. They're free to support it only at the risk of their own future, because this system isn't just out to get them over there, it's out to get us over here. We're the ones who are in the firing line as much as anyone. We're not out to force socialist views down anyone's throat. We can't force people to recognise that there's something wrong with the society they're living in. Nobody is going to force anyone to see that there's something wrong with a society which can produce 4 tons of nuclear explosive per head of the world's population, while it does not produce adequate nutrition for 2/3 of the world's population. Anyone who accepts that priority is accepting the priorities of the mad, the suicidal, and the indoctrinated. But those who are aware that there is something wrong and something does need to be done in relation to the questions about which this meeting is being run will need to ask three important questions. And I'm confining myself to dealing with them, and then I'll throw the meeting open to discussion. Firstly, how many people are dying of the cold every year? We need to know that, because you can switch on the news at 10 from now until they tell you the truth, which will be a long time, and you still won't hear how many people are dying of the cold every year. Secondly, why are they dying? Thirdly, how can we stop them dying? These are the questions, that's the issue. Now, before I answer those questions, let me make the point that the problem of those who are old and cold is not being examined from the point of view of mere moral concern for other people. The problems which face the old today are getting worse, not better. And there are very few people who can expect to enjoy sufficient economic security in old age to be able to be assured at this moment that the problems which are facing others now will not be facing us later on. In short, dying of the cold is not just a problem of those who are old and impoverished. It's a problem for the class which becomes old and impoverished as a matter of its life existence. Now, looking at the extent to which hypothermia is a significant cause of death in Britain, one is faced immediately with a problem. On the one hand, there are official figures which are produced by three different government agencies. And each of these agencies conflict with one another. So you've got to decide whether you're going to believe one of them or whether you're going to believe all of them or any of them. On the other hand, quite apart from the government's figures, there are the findings of investigations by the medical profession, and particularly by geriatric specialists. And we've got to look at those as well. Now, as you see when I present these statistics to you, there's a massive difference between what the government says is happening and what the medical investigators have found. And what you have to do is to decide whether civil servants who are answerable to politicians, who have an interest in defending the system, are likely to be presenting a more accurate picture than doctors and geriatric specialists working in the field. Let's look at the government figures first. Now, as I said, there are three different government figures. So for 1982, the Department of the Environment claimed that there were 47 people in the whole of Britain who died of hypothermia. The Office of Population and Censuses and Surveys claimed that 325 people died of hypothermia in 1982. And the Minister of Health and Social Security, or Wealth and Social Insecurity, whichever way you look at it, in an answer to a question in the House of Commons on the 18th of January 1983, declared that 685 people died of the cold during 1982. So if we believe the Minister of Health, then two people on average died of the cold every day in 1982. If we believe the Office of Population and Censuses and Surveys, it was one per day on average. If we accept the Department of the Environment, then it was one on average every week. Now, before I go on to say why all of these figures are based upon quite scandalous deceit, let me make two points. First of all, it's quite astonishing that three different government departments, talking about the number of people dying of the cold in one year, give three figures which are totally different from each other. It's even more surprising, I must add, that when I consulted each of these departments, I was the first person to tell them that they hadn't got the same figure as the other two departments. Secondly, and this is important, it should be stressed that even if the lowest of the government figures was correct, in short, even if death caused by hypothermia only amounted to one per week during 1982, that still would be an appallingly high figure. Let's not underestimate it or underplay it. Indeed, as long as it is officially admitted that one person in any year has died of the cold, society has still got a problem which needs to be investigated and needs to be eradicated. So to recap on the government figures, according to their statement in the House of Commons in January 1983, 685 people died of the cold in 1982. And I want you to remember that figure. And I'll now go on to demonstrate why it is a fallacious figure. And I'll give you some reasons. And I won't give you too many reasons. I could quote numerous ones, but I'll give you just a few. And anyone who wants to dispute them with me, they can do so in the question time with the greatest of pleasure. First of all, each year, tens of thousands more people die in the winter than in the summer. And of that number, 80% of them are over the age of 65. To give a couple of examples, in the 10 years prior to 1980, the death rate in winter was 17% higher than in summer for those aged between 60 and 69, 20% higher for those in their 70s, and 25% higher for those over 80. On average, this meant that approximately 50,000 more old people died during the winter than during the summer in each of those years. Now, if we return to the winter of 1982 for a moment, in which the government claimed 685 people died of hypothermia, we find that 42,500 more people aged over 65 died in the winter of that year than in the summer of that year. Now, the only essential difference between the winter months and the summer months is that the winter is colder. That is the only medical cause that I or anyone else I have spoken to could give for why winter months is likely to cause a greater degree of illness and death. So if over 42,000 more old people died in the cold months of 1982 than in the warmer months, and if, as is the case, this occurs annually, it would be reasonable to conclude that a large proportion of those tens of thousands of people are dying of the cold. Now, if that evidence is correct, and instead of the government figure of two deaths per week, we're dealing with a problem which is killing thousands per week during the winter months, how is that figure being disguised? Well, there are two immediate reasons that I need to just clarify. Firstly, many people who die of the cold are not found by anyone for some time after they die, because we're living in what they call a caring society. So if you're old and you die because you can't turn a heater on, nobody will necessarily find you for weeks, possibly even months after you die. And as a result, doctors aren't able to take the body temperature of the dead person, and it's impossible to tell whether they were suffering from hypothermia at the time of death. Now, according to the heating research officer at Age Concern, this accounts for at least a few thousand undiagnosed deaths caused by hypothermia every single year. Secondly, there are many doctors who are able to write on the death certificate that a person has died of hypothermia because they find the body in a condition where the person has literally frozen to death. But because it is considered to be a social stigma to die for lack of access to adequate heating, many families and social services put pressure on doctors not to mention hypothermia on the death certificate. Indeed, in a survey carried out by the Liverpool Health Authority in the 1970s, 75% of doctors admitted that on at least one occasion they had falsified the details written on the death certificates in order to avoid causing embarrassment to the families of people who died of poverty, who died of the cold. And there's a third and final and very important reason why many of the people who die of hypothermia are simply not noticed as such. And this is that the British Medical Association, the BMA, has been given the power to quite arbitrarily fix a body temperature above which a person is said to be not suffering from hypothermia. Now, you only have to think about this for a moment and you can see how easily open to abuse this is. The BMA, an establishment organisation, can set the body temperature at which a person has to be dying of the cold so low that at the end of the day, no one ever dies of hypothermia. It's like saying that no one ever dies of starving because you can define starvation in such a way that a person has got to be literally totally disintegrated before this will have happened. So, according to the BMA, if a person's body temperature is above 95 degrees Fahrenheit, then that person is not in a hypothermic condition. They're not cold. Now, as most of you will know, the official measurement of normal body temperature is 98.4 degrees. In other words, according to the British Medical Association, the government-backed highest authority in the land in the medical profession, a person of the age of 70, 80 or 90 can be found dead with a body temperature which is 3.8 degrees lower than normal body temperature for a healthy young person, and a doctor is instructed that that person has not died of the cold. It's perfectly natural and healthy. And you see, therefore, how the ruling class determine what's healthy. If they say you're well, you're well. Now, in 1972, a very important survey was carried out under the direction of the Medical Research Council, and it employed the greatest geriatric specialists from the Royal Free Hospital in London and University College Hospital. And you can read their findings, if you want to, in the January 1973 issue of the British Medical Journal. And it was a devastating attack on the BMA and on the whole theory of hypothermia and who's dying of it. Now, what this survey said in simple terms is that the authorities were covering up the extent to which people are dying of the cold simply by means of redefining what it means to be cold. They found in their survey that 1 in 10 old people whose deep body temperatures they examined were suffering from some degree of discomfort or illness as a result of their body temperatures being below 98.4, above what the BMA said was hypothermia, but below normal body temperature. Now, if that same statistic is applied to the over 65 population of Britain today, we can conclude that nearly 900,000 old people today are living in what the writers of that survey considered to be hypothermic conditions. In other words, hundreds of thousands of people in Britain today are living in conditions where their body is so cold that they are likely to become ill and they could die. Now, it would seem reasonable to conclude, and this is certainly what most of the geriatric researchers have concluded that at the moment in Britain there are something like several hundred thousand people who are permanently living in the cold. Their body temperature is below what you and I would call normal. It is also reasonable to conclude that every year there are at the very least tens of thousands of people dying of the cold. Now, this is very important when you compare it with what the government tells us, that 625 people die of the cold. Now, whichever of these various figures or analyses you accept, it's a fact which is beyond dispute that at least 100 and at most tens of thousands of people will die of the cold next winter. It's as simple as that. We can sit here now, we can make a prediction. If you had a perverse streak in you, you could go along to Ladbrokes and put a fiver on it. There will be not just hundreds, but thousands who will be dead by the end of the winter of 84-85. They died of the cold. Now, having accepted these facts, we have to ask why they occur. Is it that there are not sufficient energy resources to provide adequate heating for the population of Britain? Well, according to the economists, the opposite is the case. The opposite is the case. According to the economists, there is currently a crisis of coal and electricity overproduction. The National Coal Board has made it clear that coal production, if it is going to fit in with market demand, will need to be cut by 10 million tonnes. That's about 8% of current coal output. This means that they've got to take 20,000 miners and chuck them out of work. And you've got to realise that for every one of those 20,000 miners who's told that he's not needed, what he is being told is that the people who are going to die of the cold next winter don't need you. They are not part of what you are there to serve. At the same time, the Central Electricity Generating Board has been reducing electricity output annually over the last 6 years, as well as closing down power stations. They closed down 22 just since 1979. Why? Reduced market demand. People don't need electricity. There's no requirement for it. So, too much has been produced for the market. But clearly, there is not too much to satisfy needs, because human needs are being repeatedly unmet to the extent that tens of thousands of people are at risk, as a matter of certainty, of dying of the cold next winter. Now, a person with a simple mind, or to put it another way, a person who uses a brain as a tool for reasoning with rather than as a profit calculating machine, will look at this situation and they'll say it's quite simple. What society needs to do is to produce more coal. We need to produce more electricity. We need to produce more gas, oil, alternative power sources, let's get working on them. And we should regulate such production to fit in with what people need. Make sure that there is not a single person who is cold, who has an illness resulting from the cold, who dies of the cold in the coming winter. Simple. Now, technically, there is absolutely nothing to prevent society from generating adequate heat to satisfy the needs of every single inhabitant of the earth. I have neither seen nor come across any expert who has been able to argue that there is not the potentiality for the adequate satisfaction of the heating needs of every man, woman, and child on the earth. They might want to argue about the best way to do it, but it is beyond scientific doubt that it can be done. To be quite clear, there is no technical reason why any human being should freeze to death in their own home. Technically, no problem, it happens. There is no technical reason why any person need to be forced to make the undignified and disgusting choice between switching on a heater and opening a can of beans. It's not as if the human race has to decide every week, are we going to produce baked beans or are we going to produce heat? We're advanced, we can do both. There is, in short, no natural reason why people die of the cold. The cause is purely and simply social. Hypothermia is not a natural human disease, it is a social disease, and its cause can be defined as poverty. Indeed, it would be more appropriate to say that they die from lack of money than to say that they die from lack of heat. Why does capitalism create this poverty that denies people access to adequate heating? Because it is a system which produces wealth, all goods, all services, including heating, for sale on the market with a view to profit. You want to keep warm? Then you must buy warm. No sale, then there's no profit. No profit, then there's no production. That is the simple, cold, economic logic of capitalism. 30 million people die of starvation every year. Another example of an unmet need. But the market, which can only see buyers, which is blind to need, which is not backed up by money, it's suffering at the moment from a crisis of food overproduction. They're paying farmers not to produce it. The world has produced a milk lake, and last year 100,000 children went blind as a result of vitamin A deficiency because they lacked access to an adequate diet, including milk. And we've got a milk lake. Tens of thousands of people in Britain are homeless. These, again, are needs which the market ignores time and time again. So is the house building industry currently working at full speed? No. It's undergoing the biggest contraction since the 1920s. 500,000 unemployed building workers are told to sit at home, if they've got a home, and do nothing. Because there are plenty of people who need housing, but not enough buyers. So you see very clearly, as you follow the logic and the experience of capitalism, with its recognition of profit rather than need, that it will let people die for want of heating, it will let them die for want of food. It will let them go short of decent housing, short of decent medical facilities. Profit thrives upon poverty. Because the function of the market is to sell and not to cater for commercially unprofitable needs. Now, when you understand that capitalism is a system which by its very nature is concerned with production for profit and not for need, You'll not be surprised to find it all falls into place. That's why tens of thousands die every year of the cold. It's because capitalism isn't there to provide for their needs. It's there to sell at a profit. That's why, at this very moment, while there are old people, possibly in this street, certainly in this neighbourhood, fearing the winter, possibly undergoing as much stress, waiting for death, as they will during the course of dying of the cold. That's why at this very moment, the government and its agents are busily closing down coal mines and getting rid of energy supplies. Now, there are reformists who look at this situation and they claim that the market needs to be regulated by one government or another. It can't. For example, under the 1964 to 1970 Labour government, the number of people dying of hypothermia was exactly the same each year as during the 1970 to 74 Heath government. In 1974, there was a sudden rapid rise in the number of people dying of hypothermia every year. Why was that? Because in 1974, you had the oil crisis. Prices rushed up. In the 74 to 79 Labour government, you had the same number of people dying of hypothermia each year as you've had under the current Tory government. Governments do not make any difference. It's argued that governments ought to give subsidies to the pensioners in order to satisfy their need to pay fuel bills. There have been no less than 18 different statutes since 1964 which have attempted to alleviate the problem of the heating of old people's houses. 18 different statutes, and despite every single one of them, the number of people dying in 1982 was higher than in 1964 when they started putting the legislation through Parliament. Governments are totally powerless in the face of the market. It's one of the most fundamental lessons that any worker, any socialist needs to know. Governments in the face of profit are totally impotent. The fact of the matter is that there never has been, there never will be, any solution to the problem of poverty, any solution to the problem of deprivation, any solution to the suffering of workers, as long as the basis of production is to sell goods and services on the market at a profit. As long as the buying and selling system exists, there will be poverty. Now, that leaves you with one logical political choice. Once you've accepted that, once you've sat down, had a think, and accepted that you cannot run the market in the interest of the working class, you cannot run the buying and selling system in the interest of those who have to do the buying because they do not own the resources of the earth. Once you recognise that, there is only one logical solution, and that is to create a social order in which the wealth of the world is commonly owned and democratically controlled by the people of the world. In short, the only logical solution, the only practicable alternative, the only reasonable conception of a different way of organising things is socialism. There is no other option open, and frankly, socialists are sick and tired of the apologists for capitalism who come along periodically with their sticking plaster and tell us that there is some other option. There isn't. They can forget it. They better either defend this vicious anti-human system or get in with the socialists. Now, what is the difference between socialism and capitalism? Capitalism is a property society. You can only obtain what you need under capitalism if you can afford to buy it from those who own and control the means of wealth production and distribution, the factories, the farms, the railways, the mines, whether they are owned by the state and its bureaucracy, or whether they are owned by private capitalists. You can only afford to have access if you buy it from the property owners. Socialism, as an alternative, will be a society of common property, or more precisely, it will be a society of no property. It will be a propertyless system of society. And therefore, because there will be no property, there will be no buying or selling. People will have free access to what they commonly share, because it will be theirs. It will be ours. The world and its resources will be there for the satisfaction of our needs and our comforts, and we will cooperate to produce them, and we will cooperate to use them. In a socialist society, production will be solely for use. The concept of profit will have no existence. If coal is needed, then people will cooperate to produce coal, and they will take according to their needs. The idea of closing down coal mines when humanity needs energy resources would be unthinkable in a socialist society. In a society of free access, there would be no reason for a single person ever to die of hypothermia. There would be no reason for a single person ever to die of malnutrition. No reason for a single person ever to be told that they are not allowed to work, even though they have the talents and energies to give. No reason ever for people to die in accidents at work caused by unsafe conditions of work, because it's profitable to have them unsafe as at present. In other words, the epidemic of social maladies produced by capitalism will not exist in socialism. Unnecessary death, the unnatural sending of the slaughter of millions of people, when all is said and told, onto the altar of profit, will not be possible, conceivable, or imaginable in a socialist society. The principle of world socialism will be that each person will give according to their abilities, and they will take from the common store of society's wealth according to their self-defined needs. That is a socialist alternative. And I will conclude by making three brief points. Firstly, that when we talk about hypothermia, when we talk about poverty, when we talk about closing down coal mines, when we talk about illness, when we talk about death, every one of those concepts is political. It's not religious. The religious people want you to imagine that death has got something to do with spiritual passing from one stage to another. It's got nothing to do with spiritual passing of one stage to another. Spiritual passing is what you do in a pub. What you do when you die is you get buried and eaten by worms. So, it's quite clear that these are political issues. They are not issues to be dealt with by vicars. They're not issues to be dealt with by humanitarian ladies with floppy hats and cans for collecting pennies so that they can ease their conscience. like the people who stand by and watch somebody getting mugged and then go across afterwards and offer them a handkerchief to wipe the blood off their face. That isn't what we are interested in. These issues, solving poverty, ending hypothermia, is political. Secondly, no political party in Britain anymore, apart from the Socialist Party, even talks about the abolition of poverty. There was once a time in the last century when the Tory Party, the Liberal Party, they used to come out, the audacious lying hypocrites that they were, and they said, put us into power, we'll abolish poverty. They don't even bother to say it anymore. The Labour Party, in its early days, maybe they were naive, maybe they were drunk at the time, we don't know. They used to write manifestos about abolishing poverty. People were taken in by it. And Aaron Bevin said in 1945 that by 1951, there'd be no housing problem in Britain. People believed it. No one even promises to abolish poverty anymore. It's only the Socialist Party that can stand before the working class with our head up high and say, we've got the solution to poverty. Not some poverty. Not virtually ending poverty. Not alleviating poverty. Not sticking plaster over the worst bits of poverty. Abolishing poverty, because the only way you abolish poverty is you abolish profit. And finally, I want to say this. That a year ago, 2 years ago, how many people were killed in that Falklands War? Any person with a claim to rationality, any person with a claim to a civilized understanding of the world, or maybe I should say a primitive understanding of the world if we want to get beyond civilization, anyone who can claim that will admit that it was appalling that over 1,000 members of the working class were killed in that needless war. I put it to you that even according to the government's own figures, that number of people are dying every 2 years, freezing to death in a war they didn't want to fight. They're not waving flags. They weren't conscripted. And if you look at the reality which I have presented, where tens of thousands are dying of hypothermia every year, what we mean is that you can multiply the Falklands dead next winter, the winter after, the winter after that, the old defenseless victims in a war against their own ability to survive, which the profit system is waging. The working class has a responsibility, and the socialist duty is before us to wage war on the system that has fought very hard to put us down where we are.